Okay, that's Sally Walks the Dog. That will all become apparent why I picked that one. On the phone with me is Bob Lucius. Hi, Bob.
How are you tonight, Arnold?
Well, doing just fine, thank you. It's nice and wet out here in Sonoma County.
As it is down here in Monterey, I thought I just saw an arc go by.
Hopefully there's a spare one for up here.
That's right.
Well, welcome to Cowes.
Thanks so much.
And, wow, what an interesting story you have. A U.S. Marine officer in Vietnam in 2006. You'd had 18 years in the Marine Corps, then your life changed. Tell us about how you got to that point, so we get a bit of background of you, Bob.
Sure. I graduated from a military university in 1989 and immediately went into the Marine Corps. And, of course, I'm still on active duty. It's been 22 years now. But about 10 years ago, I had the chance to change my job specialization. I had been the kind of guy that shoots down airplanes. And they said, how would you like to go be a foreign culture and language specialist? And I said, hey, you know, that sounds like something I might be interested in. So they trained me up and sent me to school to learn languages and gave me the opportunity to live in Asia for a couple of years, and then they said, now you're going to go work in Vietnam at the U.S. Embassy, which I thought, well, pretty good deal. So one of my jobs was to distribute humanitarian aid from the Department of Defense, primarily things that, you know, were excess to our stocks, like medical equipment. And on one of the trips that I had to deliver about $1 million worth of excess Department of Defense medical assistance up to one of the small provincial medical clinics up near the Laos and Chinese border. I went up that way. It's about 10 hours up there, and about an hour or two outside of the village I was heading to, I happened to see a motorbike, and on the back of that motorbike was a wicker basket, and in that wicker basket was about four dogs were in there. And I remember just looking at one of those dogs and kind of meeting his eyes, and that dog looked back at me, and, you know, I really felt that fear and dread. That dog knew that where he was going was not going to end up someplace good. He wasn't going to the pet store. He wasn't going to the vet. You know, he wasn't going to the dog park to play with his buddies. He was on his way to a restaurant where he would be slaughtered for soup and stew or stir fry, whatever the dish was for the night.
And that is a normal thing in Vietnam, then, to
You know, it is. You know, particularly in the north and a little bit in the south as well. You know, just like in other parts of Asia, the Philippines, although it's illegal in the Philippines, it's still a very large black market trade in China, and of course Korea is well known for its dog meat. But in Vietnam, they, you know, cats are fair game as well, although not as it's not as, you know, prodigious as dogs.
Yeah.
So I knew where they were going, and I thought to myself, I got to do something about this. But, you know, I'm a trained culture specialist. I didn't want to be a cultural imperialist. I didn't want to be the guy to, you know, to raise my Vietnamese counterpart's hackles and, you know, be critical of their culture. I mean, we have our own faults, obviously. And so I'm going over this in my head, and by the time I got it sorted out what I was going to do, was stop that motorbike and buy him and set him free, the motorbike had gone. So later that day, I was in a restaurant after all my work had been done, being treated to a delicious, you know, lunch by my hosts. And on the way out the door, I just happened to glance over my shoulder toward the kitchen, and I saw a dead skinned dog on the floor.
Ooh.
It had just been killed and skinned, and it was getting ready to be cut up for the various dishes for the evening. And that's when, frankly, you know, the light switched on for me, and I became a vegetarian right then and there, and subsequently a vegan, and I decided I need to do something to change my ways and to fight for the animals.
Wow, what an epiphany. You know, you'd been through, you know, obviously, you know, battles and wars type of thing, and yet something like that, a simple thing like that, just totally changed you.
You know, it's amazing. It's they have a word for that. It's called cognitive dissonance. Mm. And a researcher by the name of Barbara McDonald several years ago did a paper about why people become vegans. And generally, it always comes down to a catalytic experience just like that, you know. And you can have it over and over and over again, but at one time, it just clicks, and it is an epiphany. I mean, it's the light going from dark to, you know, to on, and it throws light on all those little dirty secrets that you had in your life, the things that you've been trying to ignore.
Right, right. Have you had dogs as pets? Back in the States, so is that?
You know, I did. Growing up, I had a small dog. Died when I was about 10 years old, and I'd had. I've always been more of a cat person, frankly. I've got a rescue cat from Vietnam right now that I brought back, and a local rescue. But I love dogs, and always been kind of an animal person, but not a. You know, an animal welfare person. You certainly don't want to be cruel to animals, but never, I never would have imagined myself as an animal rights person. You know, those folks are crazy. But here I am.
You got the bug.
That's right. You know, it just takes one moment of clarity to, to bring it all home.
So, incredible. So from that point, how did you go about that change? Were you still there and doing the with that change, or did you come back to America?
It's interesting. I had a couple more years in Vietnam, and I had been doing some work on the side with leper communities. And there's still quite a few folks suffering from the residual effects of years and years of leprosy. So I had been working with them, and I had been doing a number of other volunteer things with youth leadership. And really, I was struggling to try to figure out, you know, what could I do for the animal struggle. And honestly, it wasn't until I came back to the States that the plan really formulated in my head, and I really knew what I wanted to do. And I was very fortunate because I had the opportunity as a U.S. government diplomat to make a lot of connections, both in the nonprofit world and in the government world. And I've been able to leverage all of those connections in Vietnam to build some programs that are really designed to fire up young people to become grassroots advocates in their own country, you know, for them to take the lead in the struggle rather than a foreigner coming in and trying to stir up the pot.
Yeah, because that's such a sensitive cultural issue. You would be right in the middle of it doing it that way.
Absolutely. And that's they know how they need to fight that struggle. And the question is, how do we empower them? How do we give them confidence? How do we give them skills? How do we give them the awareness and the information that they need to make the right decisions? And then just kind of winding them up and letting them go.
Right.
And then being there to mentor them and encourage them. And in some cases, provide a little bit of funding to them, seed money to get the ball rolling.
Right. Now, to start that, did you have to literally go through the government let that start to happen, and how was that process? And
I think you talk to a lot of even the big international NGOs, non-governmental organizations that try to work in places like Vietnam and China, in very closed countries. It's almost impossible, especially if you want to reach out and touch youth, because education is such a sensitive issue, and largely because they're very ideologically driven countries, and education is a tool that is used to shape citizens that will support the current political economic system, and you cannot go in and start tinkering with their finely tuned system. However, because I'd made all these contacts and all these private groups that are founded and run by Vietnamese, I can use those folks as, the leverage to get into places. So I'm working with one particular group in the north called IOGT Vietnam. It's a youth leadership group. They've never in their wildest imaginations thought about animal rights, animal protection, animal welfare. However, I've linked up with them through my prior work, and I said, hey, this is what I want to do. This is what I'm willing to fund. This is the kind of the program I want to put together for humane education. You've got some experience in these particular educational techniques. I know you have access to get into the schools. How about helping me by letting me use that access to deliver this program? and they were, you know, excited about it. And so we're working together. So the Vietnamese government doesn't see my face at all. All they see are Vietnamese faces.
Oh, that sounds good, yeah. Much, much stronger approach, yes. And how did you explain to those groups, your stance? Was it something they'd never thought of before? It was alien to them, and how did you make that cultural twist?
I mean, that's a great question because I didn't go in there guns blazing with my animal rights ideology. I went in there saying, hey, look. You know what your cultural norms are. You know the concepts of compassion, kindness to all creatures. I mean, it's a country that's 80% nominally Buddhist.
Mm.
Of course, that's been shaded by communist ideology. There's about 10% Christian, primarily Catholic, in that country. But they have these norms. Now the question is whether they express those norms through behavior. And so I went in there and said, hey, look, let's explore what your normative values are, and if in fact the way that you're acting toward the animal world, toward the environment, toward each other really reflect those norms. And let's explore that, in a discussion and see where it takes us.
Hmm.
And that's something they've been extremely open to because it really is a discussion more than a monologue.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can find their way on their own. And I'm very confident that, perhaps not all of them initially will become, diehard animal rights people. But I know some of them will, and I only need some of them. I only need a very small percentage of the folks that we're reaching out and touching to become extremely, passionate about this. And then I'll use those folks and expand the breach, if I can use some military terminology.
Oh, interesting. And is there a difference between men and women who you work with? Is it more women or more men, or is it no difference?
No, actually, that's one of the surprising things. I mean, I think my experience has been in the United States that the movement on the ground is by and large dominated by women. But in Vietnam, most of the, particularly in the South, I'm working with a group called Yao Dong Ba, which means animal lovers, and they go out and they rescue dogs and cats off the street, some from the meat trade, and then they nurse them back to health, socialize them, and find them adoptive homes. But it's a good split. It's probably 60-40%, 60% women, 40% men, but much more men involved and interested than I would have expected.
Well, that's a very good sign, it seems like, yeah.
It really is, because it is kind of, there is a little bit more of the macho sort of expressiveness in that society. And so I was really surprised and gladdened.
Mm-hmm. Now, in those discussions, I mean, was it something, you're talking about it, and did that, is just a few minutes of discussion, or is this like over hours that you have to work through it for them? Or how is it accepted?
Yeah, and I think it's a fairly innovative approach to humane education. Most humane education you get is about raising awareness, about providing information, having discussions. We use a theatrical approach.
Mm.
And it really is, it's been tuned to address a number of socio-psychological factors that encourage behavioral change. And so what we do is we develop a number of vignettes that there's always, they always end badly. So I'll give you an example. One is a dog tied to a tree in front of a shop. And that dog is kept in the shop at night to protect the property from burglars. And during the day, it's tied up to the tree in front. Doesn't get any attention, doesn't get any water, doesn't get any food. And so two young kids walk by the dog every day, and they realize what's going on, and they want to resolve the dilemma. They want to do something to help the dog, but what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
And so that vignette is acted out on stage by some of our volunteer performers, and then it ends badly, but then they restart it. Any number of times, and audience members who we're performing to get to raise their hand and say, hold on a second, I have an idea. And then they get on stage, and they try to act out their idea to see if they can take the action in a more positive direction. And they keep going through this iteratively until everybody in the audience and on stage is satisfied that that's the best possible solution. And the idea is that by actually acting out, and psychology tells us this, that by acting out behaviors, we internalize them. We always think of we got to change our beliefs and our attitudes before we'll act differently. But what really happens is often we act in a certain way and we change our internal disposition to match our outward behavior. And so what I'm hoping, is, and this is a pilot project, we're testing this out, is that by going through several of these vignettes over and over and over again, time and, you know, as they change, but common similar threads throughout them, people will begin to internalize the lessons of what they're acting out. And through the social proof principle, where we try to mirror other people who we are close to and who we respect and trust, it will become almost like a contagion.
Mm. Very interesting approach. That is fascinating that everyone gets involved in that. That's just beautiful.
Well, and the beauty is it is very similar to what the Vietnamese have done pedagogically for centuries. Mm. When they've gone out and they've tried to teach villagers who are largely illiterate, not anymore, but in past years, the complex, you know, ideological principles of the Communist Party, how do you do that for people who are largely illiterate? Well, you use theater, you use drama and culture. You have performers that go out and they teach through these creative arts. And so what we've done is we've essentially co-opted their own pedagogy and then used it for animal rights.
Okay. Very interesting. And do you speak Vietnamese?
You know, a little bit. I got to tell you, I was trained in Indonesian, and then they gave me a few months of Vietnamese, and I picked up a little bit, obviously, when I was in country, but it's not near as strong as it should be.
I imagine in Vietnam, a lot of them want to learn English. I understand that's their passion.
Yeah, it really, it's in the last probably 10 years or so, it's become the primary language of choice. It used to be Russian. Now, you know, Chinese is starting to pick up a little bit, but by and large, English is, you know, everybody loves America in Vietnam.
Wow.
It's surprising, right? Because when I got there, I thought, man, everyone's going to hate me because of the war.
Yeah.
But that was not the case at all.
Interesting. Very interesting. Wow. It's nice to feel that we can be forgiven for the awful sins we've done.
Absolutely, you know, and most of the the vast majority of the population is under the age of 35. Hmm. You know, there's no recollection of the war, and what they have learned in the history books really is not a very strong indictment of the United States as much as it is an indictment of the U.S. government. So the U.S. You know, population, the American citizens, the people, we get off, you know, pretty scot-free.
Okay.
So, grudges.
And is there any difference in reaction in the different ethnic groups in Vietnam?
You know, that's a great question, too. There are 54 ethnic groups in Vietnam.
Mm.
And the vast majority, about 80% of the country, the majority are ethnic Kin. And so when you're in Hanoi or Ho Chi Minh City or Hue or Da Nang, any of the big cities, you're dealing mostly with the Kin. And it's only when you get off into the mountains that you start dealing with ethnic minority hill tribes or folks in the Central Plateau. And so I haven't dealt with them a lot on this particular topic. But it's an interesting question because many of them still practice animist religions.
Mm.
I mean, they're still very much tied to the land. And so I think that would be very interesting to pursue in terms of a research study to see what their attitudes are.
Yeah, and how is their reaction, you know, obviously to your work, and do some become vegetarians or vegans? Is it something they even think about?
Oh, in Vietnam? Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely. You know, in fact, I'm one of the side projects I'm working on. I was very lucky to get a $1,000 grant from the Well-Fed World Foundation.
Hmm.
Which Dawn Moncrief runs. She used to be the executive director of the farm animal rights movement.
Yeah.
They gave me a $1,000 grant to help me work with a Vietnamese organization called Live and Learn. It's a branch of Live and Learn International to develop a vegetarian, it's actually a vegan cookbook, which takes Vietnamese traditional comfort foods and then makes them into, you know, vegan variants.
Mm.
So no things like fish sauce or, you know, shrimp paste or any of those fancy condiments made with animal products. It's all vegan, and it will have several, much like the vegan transition guides that PETA or Compassion Over Killing put out. They have little blurbs in there about why that sort of diet is good for the environment, good for animals, good for people, good for public health. And we'll all be in Vietnamese, and we'll distribute them for free throughout the country. And they hold events all the time encouraging people to go vegetarian, and they have quite a following.
Beautiful. We're speaking with Bob Lucius, who is working for humane treatment of animals, mainly in Vietnam. Now, have you worked in any other Asian countries or just Vietnam so far?
Well, I mean, I previous to Vietnam, I worked in Indonesia, and and I still go back there once a year. And I'm very enthusiastic about trying to take this humane education model, which we call humane edutainment, and trying to lift it and move it to Vietnam, where the pedagogical methods are a little bit different. The art forms are a little bit different. They use shadow puppetry and things like that. So I would very much like to try to use those sorts of art forms in Indonesia for the same end. So we're hoping to do that maybe next year. We'll wrap up the pilot in Vietnam probably end of August, early September of this year, and then give us some time to do some analysis and then try to continue and then maybe move it someplace else as well.
Right. And do you, how often do you go back to Vietnam to oversee this and work with it?
Well, you know, I try to get back, a couple times a year. I was just back there in November. I probably won't go back again, maybe till late summer, if that's possible. And that's the beauty of really leveraging existing groups on the ground. I have complete confidence. They report to me, weekly that they are, marching forward with the plan and, executing as planned. And so I'm really quite comfortable, kind of sitting back here and letting them be the masters of their own destiny.
Right. Well, that is it. The whole arrogance of of our Western, putting our Western things on them. That's the thing is not to do. And I really appreciate you being so sensitive to that.
Well, it's hard because those of us who are passionate about it, we want to be in the fight. We want to get our hands dirty and be there in the trenches. Mm-hmm. And you got to really fight that urge and step back because they'll never spread their wings if you don't let them.
Well, that's it. Yeah, and it won't stick.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? If it's just you, once you go away, it doesn't have that the power.
I mean, it really is all about confidence, and they have to develop. They've got great instincts. They've got great skills. They know what needs to be done. They just need to have the confidence, to step up there and enter the fray.
Oh, yeah. And what organizations do you work with in America who help you and back you?
Well, I've been really lucky. I've received a very generous grant from Humane Society International for the Humane Education Program. As I said, the Well-Fed World has supported us. We've been supported by Farm Animal Rights Movement. And just lots of great grassroots support getting the word out. Groups like StopCrush.org and Ayala have been very helpful to us getting the word out. The beauty of, about a year ago, I never even heard of Facebook. But since I've got on it, I've been exposed to a whole new world of what is possible with social media. And just being able to reach out and touch thousands of fellow animal rights activists, getting that support, the emotional support when times get tough, getting the expertise when subject matter expertise is required, and it's all there at your fingertips. It's been just a tremendous resource.
Yes, most powerful. It's certainly the different people I've been interviewing. It just seems it's vital now. You need that basis of Facebook and those social networks.
Absolutely. We've got a little group where our friends in Vietnam get to interact with our friends in the United States, and that is so important because one of the problems, a lot of our folks in Vietnam, they speak English, but they may not speak it well, and they may not read it well, and so they really are isolated in a language bubble. When they can get onto a thing like Facebook and try to communicate and have the chance to interact, suddenly they're not so alone. The things that they've had, that they believe in, the vision that they have for their country, suddenly doesn't seem quite so unusual when they realize that other people around the world feel exactly the same way about their countries and what's going on in their countries. And it becomes really a global community for these folks, and that is critical for them moving forward.
Oh, fascinating, fascinating. Now, obviously, dogs and cats were your main focus, but I know in Asia, I mean, they eat, you know, it seems like they eat monkeys and other mammals. How do you deal with those type of issues?
Yeah, well, that's right. If it flies, slithers, crawls, swims, climbs a tree, you can bet it's going to be on somebody's plate. And, you know, I did a pretty thorough analysis of what was going on in Vietnam before I got involved. And there are a number of organizations, domestic, international, that are working wildlife conservation issues. And I have contacted them. We had we conducted a seminar in November, and I invited all those organizations to participate. Many of them did. And they are focused on the wildlife aspect, and they're doing a good job at it. But they're not, by and large, animal welfare, animal rights people. They are about conservation. There is no other organization, with the exception of Animals Asia Foundation, who works with bears, in Vietnam, working with animals from the perspective of either animal welfare or animal rights. And that's why I was really fired up to try to get something going, because although it may be embryonic, they need to have that initial spark, you know, that hopefully will grow into a blaze in the next couple of years.
Right, and then obviously you'll get the flow out to all those, you know, endangered creatures and whatever. They will get the benefit of that.
Yeah, and the younger generation really doesn't buy into a lot of that stuff. So, you know, I can see, you know, for a bear bile is a perfect example. They have been, that has been illegal for a number of years. There's still abuses and black market bear bile extraction and the sale of bear bile, primarily for the international trade and tourists that come in from China and Korea. But, you know, when you talk to a lot of the youth, a lot of the messaging that these international NGOs have done about don't do it when it comes to bear bile has really taken hold. And I was really surprised because of a lot of these young kids, when it came to the dog meat trade, they were very much, well, you know, it's been, you know, a part of our culture for so long, I can't see us getting rid of it. But when I asked about bear bile, they said, no, that's completely wrong, inappropriate.
Huh.
And it's only been a number of years that these public service announcements on television and in print have taken place, but it's had a profound effect, and they don't even realize how pervasive it has become in changing their attitudes about bears. And I'm sure the same thing could happen with dogs if it's done smartly.
Hmm. Obviously, they eat dogs, but you also say they use them as guard dogs. Do some people have them as purely pets?
Yeah, you know, and you know, the name of my organization is called the Kairos Coalition, and Kairos is a Greek word. It means the right or opportune moment. It's a moment in destiny. It's a moment, I should say, a moment in time when destiny collides with linear time, and when if you seize that moment, you can really achieve something magnificent. And Vietnam's at that point right now in its development as an industrializing economy. It used to be that everybody had a dog. Nobody named their dog. You know, they fed it, you know, whatever fell off the table or whatever it could get on its own. They locked it up downstairs in their house to protect against burglars. And then when it got old enough or sick enough, they would kill it and maybe, you know, either sell it or eat it themselves. But what's happened in the last number of years with the growing middle class and, you know, a small minority of super rich is companion animals, I mean real genuine companion animals, in many cases rare breeds of dogs, have become very much cachet. And so lots of folks are having them. They're, you know, they're calling them their names. They're dressing them up. You can buy imported pet food and imported toys. There's more and more veterinary services available. And so it is now a great time to leverage that newfound interest and appreciation for companion animals and use that as leverage to introduce these concepts of animal welfare. And before, you know, 5 years ago, if you said, love your dog, they would be like, you're crazy. But now people know what it is to love their dog or their cat as a member of their family.
Mm. Oh, that is truly fascinating. Now, is that part of, I suppose, you know, are the family structures changing somewhat in Vietnam because of the move to the middle class and more wealth? Has that created more of that Western look at things like that?
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, that's bound to happen. Of course, they're resisting it, but that whole concept of the nuclear family, where it was multi-generational, where the grandparents and the parents and the son and his wife and their kids would live in one house, there's still plenty of that going on, don't get me wrong. But there's more and more people that are, you know, getting out on their own and getting their own apartments and, mm-hmm. you know, living a more westernized kind of life. And so, you know, that's changing the cultural landscape as well. So, you know, all these factors are driven by the economy. And that's what makes this point in time so important to reach out to Vietnam, because, you know, they're just beginning to start thinking about factory farms because of, you know, more wealth means let's eat more meat, you know, let's drink more milk, let's wear more leather products. And so they're beginning to explore factory farms, they're beginning to explore all those things that come with an industrialized society. And if we can teach them now to make better decisions than we made 50 years ago, maybe the outcomes will be different.
Very good point. Yeah, to jump over that, what the mess we went through, yeah.
I mean, I think we owe that to them, you know, to share with them the lessons of what we've experienced. And now, you know, look at our public health situation and, you know, the rampant obesity and diabetes. Mm-hmm. And you look at over there and you're starting to see problems with diabetes. You're starting to see young kids showing obesity, you know, symptoms of obesity and health, respiratory health problems. And this can all be tracked to changes in their diet that now reflects more of the Western influence.
Right. That's, yeah. Interesting, isn't it? Culturally, how do you, keep that balance? That's interesting, and not fall the same way we have, yeah.
Well, you know, in we're starting with, in many places in the South, I'm working with the group on rescuing dogs and cats. And, you know, and it's, I love dogs and cats, don't get me wrong. But, you know, it's a much bigger issue. It's a much bigger goal than simply the dogs and the cats. But the dogs and the cats are the doorway. When you start getting people concerned about dogs and cats and committed to that problem, then you can expand the breach and then start to bring in farm animals. And then you can, you know, you can talk about the wildlife conservation. You can talk about the fisheries. You can talk about eggs and you can talk about dairy. You can start to bring all these other issues. And then they get it, you know, mm-hmm. because they've got a reference point to move from.
Yes, indeed, and absolutely. So how do you see this playing out over the next couple of years, your involvement, and which what areas are you going to push and stress?
Well, we're going to continue with the humane education program in the north, and hopefully the pilot is successful, and then we can expand that program a little bit, create multiple teams that will go around. And, of course, the idea is the teams will snowball in size over time and then kind of duplicate, kind of like an amoeba as it grows. Mm-hmm. And then as more volunteers express an interest to joining the troop. In the south, we're going to work with this group, and hopefully what we plan to do in the next year is to actually build the first, you know, I hesitate to use the word shelter. It's not a shelter. It's a transition facility for when they rescue these animals. They have some place to keep them while they're nursed back to health and resocialized until their adoptive homes are ready. And so this will be the first kind of embryonic sort of, you know, stab at kind of a quote-unquote shelter. And then hopefully we can get from there to something like what is going on in Thailand with soy dogs in Phuket or SCAD Bangkok in Bangkok. No kidding, rescue operation and rehoming operation for dogs and cats. Mm. And then, you know, after that, it really is the sky's the limit for those folks, you know. And we'll be here to, you know, to mentor them, to provide them advice, to put them in contact with experts, with experience who can give them guidance and hopefully, you know, provide them funding as well as much as we can, but to try to step back as much as we can as well, because, you know, ultimately it is their country, it's their fight. You know, and although we are a global movement, mm-hmm. you know, they're the ones that have to take it across the finish line.
Right, exactly. And what other countries do you see coming up that you would like to see that spread to imminently?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of the countries have a fairly good footprint of organizations out there. Philippines has a number of organizations working, Singapore, obviously, Thailand. Indonesia, I think, there's a couple good organizations. There's the Jakarta Animal Aid Network in Jakarta. There's Bali Street Dogs in Bali, of course. But it's an extremely huge country of, you know, 220 million people, wow. 356 different ethnic groups. Groups, various languages spread, you know, from the northern tip of Aceh out to Irian Jaya. It is a huge opportunity for animal welfare to go there, animal rights to go there, and so I would like to go there next because I think there's a lot of good that can be done, and nobody's really focusing on that country right now.
Wow, what a mission!
Yeah, but even better if we can send Vietnamese there.
Yes.
You know, other fellow Asians to go there and share their experiences and work with them, that would be even better.
Right. And in this country, do you need, can you give out your website or email address if anybody's interested in this and would like to join what you're doing? Who should they contact?
Yeah, absolutely. The website is www.kairos, that's K-A-I-R-O-S, coalition.org. Mm-hmm. And the email is exec director@kairoscoalition.org. So exec director@kairoscoalition.org. And yeah, we're always, you know, we'd love to hear from folks who have ideas. I mean, that's my number one thing is I love to hear from folks who have great ideas. Yeah. We always love money, of course. I don't generally solicit donations unless we have something very specific for the money to go toward. Mm-hmm. If we've got a project plan with a definitive budget, then certainly we need funds. But what I really like is folks who say, hey, you know, I'd like to be part of this. I've got some great ideas, or I'd like to go with you on the next trip. Last trip, I took two folks with me. Mm-hmm. I would like to communicate. I'd like to be a mentor to some of these folks. I'd like to be on your Facebook group and have an opportunity to interact with some of your Vietnamese youth and share ideas and thoughts and experiences. I mean, that would be great if folks wanted to do that.
Yeah, and is there anything that you've learned there and brought back that surprised you, that was something you hadn't expected?
You know, interesting. I hate to almost share this, but when we first started doing these vignettes, I was really surprised at how the solutions always seem to take on a violent aspect. And, you know, when I realized that, you know, this happens in a lot of politically repressive societies where, I mean, I think you saw this just recently in Egypt as well, where people have to keep things bottled up inside of them. Mm-hmm. And then when they come out in a very explosive way. And so, you know, in addition to this methodology being a good way for folks to learn how to solve these problems and in a compassionate way, you know, it really is a way for them to gain what Leon Festinger would call self-efficacy. It's a way for them to express themselves in a nonviolent way and realize that, wow, I can really solve the problem and achieve my goals in a very constructive way without having to raise my voice or be violent. Mm-hmm. I am powerful. I have more powerful. I'm more powerful than I ever thought I was.
Wow, that is powerful. I get that. Yes, when it comes from within like that, it's 10 times the power.
Absolutely.
Beautiful. Wow. What an interesting subject, Bob. Wow, what a thing to take on from an epiphany 5 years ago. What a change. I mean, the people you've met, the places you've been, the things you've done, you couldn't have dreamed of, I imagine.
No, absolutely not. You know, I got to say, I've had a great career. I'm getting ready to retire in a few months, and 22 years as a Marine, done a lot of amazing things. I've had a lot of great benefits from my service. Been given a lot of great opportunities. But of all those things, the opportunity to have that awakening on the road, on my way to Lai Châu, and the life that is open to me subsequent to that has been the biggest blessing by far.
Wow, very powerful, and that's it, isn't it? When it touches the heart, anything can happen.
You betcha.
Well, thank you so much, Bob, for your what you've told us. I hope people have had a big impact in to people who've been listening and made them think.
Thanks, Arnold. I really appreciate the opportunity to come on the show and chat with you.
Oh, a pleasure, and really the best of luck. And it sounds really a fabulous work. And keep it up.
Thanks again, and Semper Fi.
Indeed. Semper Fi. Thank you, Bob.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.